Superintendent of Public Instruction Denise Juneau makes a decision on running for the U.S. Senate. Good evening, I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Jovetich, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has a remembrance of former First Lady Betty Babcock. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with three young women who are bicycling across the country. Superintendent of Public Instruction Denise Juneau is joining other top Democrats who have rejected a run for the U.S. Senate. Juneau said today that she will not be running for the Senate seat being vacated by U.S. Senator Max Baucus. She also ruled out a run for the U.S. House. Juneau says she prefers her current job. Baucus's retirement announcement created the first battle for an open Senate seat in the state since the 1970s, but at this point there are no announced frontrunners. Former Governor Brian Schweitzer, State Insurance Commissioner Monica Lindeen, and political veteran Stephanie Shriok have all declined runs for the Democrats. Lieutenant Governor John Walsh has not ruled out a run for the office. On the Republican side, U.S. Representative Steve Daines is considered a likely candidate.
And another news from around the state, former Montana First Lady Betty Babcock has died. The wife of former Governor Tim Babcock passed away yesterday in Helena. She was 91 years old. Betty Babcock was known for pushing hard for passage of the 1972 Montana Constitution, renovation of the state capitol building, and other issues. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has this remembrance.
Montana Republican Party Chairman Will Deshaw describes her as an immeasurably kind woman who wouldn't say an ill word about anyone.
I remember a time when my wife walked up to her and said, "What a lovely brooch that is. Where can I find one?" And she said, "Right here," and just handed it to her. That's the type of person that she was.
Born Betty Lee, she met Tim Babcock in high school. They married in 1941, and she worked in a Glendive ration office while he fought in Europe in World War II. Tim Babcock was elected to the lieutenant governor's office in 1960 after serving as a Republican state legislator. He took over as governor in 1962 after then-governor Donald Nutter died in a plane crash. Babcock was governor until 1969 with Betty by his side as first lady. Afterwards, she served as a Republican delegate to the 1972 Montana Constitutional Convention. Longtime state politics reporter with Lee Newspapers, Chuck Johnson, says she served an important role.
I think Betty particularly because the convention was dominated by Democrats, big Democratic majority. But Betty Babcock, unlike some Republicans in the convention, went out and was a strong advocate for its passage.
Johnson says Babcock donated an office in Helena's Colonial Inn, then owned by her and her husband, that served as home base for get-out-the-vote efforts on ratification of the Constitution.
It squeaked by about 2,500 votes, and I think Betty's role was very significant.
Betty Babcock went on to serve in the Montana House of Representatives, and later in life, she volunteered her time to raise money for causes she believed in, such as a major restoration of the state capitol building in the 90s, or construction of a new Montana Historical Society Museum building, which has yet to come to fruition. Johnson says Babcock was a committed Republican, but some of the big projects she championed were outside the party.
She really reached across party lines. She was a beloved figure on both sides of the aisle.
Montana GOP Chairman Will Deshaw says the state needs more people in public service like Betty Babcock, people willing to bridge political gaps.
She made up her mind that things would be a benefit for the state and or the party, and she convinced people that it was so, and that will be missed.
She went to the 1984 Republican National Convention as a Montana delegate for Ronald Reagan. Serving alongside her was a 21-year-old Montana State University student named Steve Daines. Daines is now Montana's U.S. congressman.
I've always looked up to Betty Babcock as an example of the kind of people that we want to see in Montana involved in leading and serving our state. She is gracious. She understands that public service is about serving the people. It's not about the people serving the government.
Daines says her kind heart extended to all Montanans, regardless of party. The Montana State website has a history of the passage of the 1972 Constitution. In it, Betty Babcock says cooperation was key to that document's success. "We didn't fight each other," she said. "We didn't always agree, but we did work together." I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
Governor Steve Bullock's office has announced Betty Babcock will lie in-state in the Capitol Building's rotunda this Thursday from 7 a.m. to 2 p.m. The public is invited to attend. Flags across the state will also be flown at half-mast on Thursday.
Since the recent showers and cooler temperatures in west central Montana, firefighters have been able to control and contain most fires in the area. Today, Missoula County fire officials downgraded the fire danger from extreme to very high. However, the rainy weather only gave short-term relief. By midweek, the hot and dry conditions supposed to return, making it difficult for an initial attack. Lolo National Forest spokesman Chris Johnson says that last week's rain helped, but it will only take 1 hour of direct sunlight to get those fine dead fuels ready to burn.
So every firefighter knows that this last week was just a break, and we've got most of our fire season ahead of us.
Due to expected hot weather and recent human-caused fires, fire managers in the West Central Montana Restrictions area will maintain Stage 1 fire restrictions on federal, state, county, tribal, and municipality areas.
Folks are also going to notice that, you know, we went from extreme to very high, and we kept the Stage 1 restrictions in place because since last week when we went in, since last Thursday, we went into Stage 1 restrictions, which limits where people can actually have campfires. We still responded as an interagency group to 8 human-caused fires over the weekend. So Stage 1 restrictions are maintained in the Missoula area.
To find out current restrictions and their locations, visit firerestrictions.us.
The company hired to move 2 large water purification units through Idaho and Montana en route to an oil sands project in Canada has announced plans to begin moving its first load tonight. The Idaho Transportation Department on Friday issued a permit for Omega Morgan to begin moving the 225-foot-long loads from the port of Wilma near Clarkston, Washington, and along scenic U.S. Highway 12 in north central Idaho. ITD advised the company that the U.S. Forest Service has jurisdiction to review the permit. However, Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest Supervisor Rick Brazell tells the Lewiston Tribune that he does not believe the Forest Service has the authority to stop the shipments. The Nez Perce Tribal Executive Committee passed a resolution yesterday opposing the shipments and urging the Forest Service to block them.
The state is asking a judge to back its revised lethal injection procedures and dismiss claims that the changes still put condemned prisoners at risk of unnecessary suffering. Assistant Attorney General Mark Fowler says the American Civil Liberties Union and 2 Montana death row inmates are rehashing old arguments that have already been decided and bringing up new ones that should be barred by District Judge Jeffrey Sherlock. Fowler asked Sherlock in Friday's court filing to reject the request to rule the execution method changes unconstitutional. Sherlock ruled in September that state law requires 2 drugs to be used, not 3. He also ruled the previous procedures did not ensure qualified individuals were verifying the inmate was incapable of feeling pain. Fowler says January's changes to the execution method addressed Sherlock's concerns.
A former secretary at Lakeside Elementary School has pleaded not guilty to embezzling nearly $9,000 from a union account for which she served as treasurer. The Daily Interlake reports 36-year-old Sandy Hawks pleaded not guilty to felony theft during a district court hearing in Flathead County on Thursday. Court records say a co-worker of Hawks told authorities that Hawks confessed to taking about $5,000 from the summer's classified employee union account. An investigation determined nearly $9,000 was missing. Hawks' next hearing is set for October 16th.
A survivor of a flash flood that destroyed part of a Montana ghost town last month says she and her family are lucky to be alive. Christy Skelton of Corvallis tells the Ravalli Republic she was vacationing with family in Bannock State Park on July 17th when a torrent of muddy, icy water came hurtling through the historic ghost town. She said she was holding on to a fence post with her 9-year-old cousin when a building collapsed and came toward them. She let go of the fence post rather than being struck by the building. In the ordeal, she suffered severe cuts on her knees. Montana park officials say the popular tourist destination will be closed for several more weeks at least. The park's historic assay office was destroyed, boardwalks were torn out, and other buildings damaged. Cleanup and repair operations have begun.
Lewis and Clark County officials have released the names of a Helena couple killed in a 2-vehicle crash north of the city on Friday afternoon. Coroner Mickey Nelson says the crash killed 78-year-old Donald Workman and his wife, 57-year-old Sandra J. Workman. Donald Workman died at the scene shortly before 3 p.m., while his wife died at the hospital about 2 hours later. Nelson says both suffered massive internal injuries. The Montana Highway Patrol says the driver of the car the Workmans were riding in failed to yield to traffic on Lincoln Road and was struck by a sport utility vehicle. The Workmans were sitting on the passenger side of the car. Another person injured in the crash was flown to Harborview Medical Center in Seattle.
A 46-year-old Billings man has died in a motorcycle crash that may have been caused by a medical condition. The Montana Highway Patrol says the man was northbound on Blue Creek Road, about 12 miles south of Billings, yesterday afternoon when he drove straight through a curve in the road. The bike landed in the grass and the driver was thrown from the motorcycle. Trooper Aaron Freivald says the man suffered a neck injury and died at the scene. The Yellowstone County Coroner's Office will conduct an autopsy to determine the cause of death. The man's name was being withheld until family members were notified.
Three young women are bicycling from California to New York this summer, gathering information about seeds, meeting people who produce and save seeds, tradition that revolves around seeds, and local agriculture. Carmen Taylor, Vicky Lee, and Coco Barrios, all friends from UC Berkeley, developed Seeds to Cities, a multimedia project that, as they put it, uses sound and stories to explore the farm, the city, and the forgotten frontiers in between. The ladies recently spent a few days in Missoula and stopped by our studios and introduced themselves to Edward O'Brien. Coco says all three members of the team have different motivations for embarking on this cross-country adventure.
We just graduated from college, and I've lived in California all my life, and I have no idea, like, what the rest of my country really looks like or how people actually live and interact in different settings and landscapes within our country. And so for me, I think that was, like, my first step. It's just, like, let's go across on bicycles so that I can get a really good feel for this place that I call home. And then we were just talking about how we feel like the landscape of our country is changing. And obviously, seeds is a big buzzword as of late.
Is it?
I think so. Or at least maybe in the communities that I surround myself with, just like GMOs, like Monsanto, you're starting to hear these little sound bites a lot more. And so obviously, this is a very crucial subject, but we wanted to take a different lens on a seed rather than say why these companies are bad or why this is, like, you know, a negative thing. We wanted to bring back into our country's consciousness of why seeds are important to us as human beings in the first place, and more of a celebration, a vignette of stories surrounding seeds.
Yeah, and in ways, I think when we try to boil it down and filter it, it comes back to this question of, how do seeds create the roots of our culture? Where do we come from? Who are we? What am I? What is this thing? How do we pass on things? How do we carry things and leave them to be inherited? What do we choose to be inherited? And what are we creating for the future?
So seeds in this case are indeed agricultural seeds, but also a metaphor for something a little bigger.
Exactly. Yeah. It's kind of an incredible conversation starter to get people to start talking about the places they live. And a lot of people that we've talked to so far have been growers and farmers and also some urbanists, but that really are in a lot of ways caretakers and know a lot about the land because that's where they work and that's what they do. And so it's kind of been this process of discovery and learning every step of the way. And like in a way that Coco was saying, learning about these regions of the United States, that I think biking is such a powerful way to be just immersed in the smells and these transitions coming from Walla Walla, Washington through this very flat, dry landscape and then dipping into the Clearwater Forest and being like, there's green again. Just those little things too. And talking to people along the way really adds a lot of meaning and makes us dwell in the places instead of just biking through and saying, oh, okay, we're seeing that, cool, we're seeing this. It's connecting the landscape for me in a lot of ways, and that connection is through people.
And letting that curiosity sort of run wild with the people we meet and interact with, and learning so much about the particularities, the things that are endemic to that area, and learning about local knowledge, regional knowledge of each place that we spend time in.
And I'm sure you've met a lot of interesting people, at least so far along the way. Any one or two people stick out in your minds that you could tell us about?
Oh, gosh. They're just so bad. So I just flood in.
I know. I'm afraid to start the stories because
it'll be a flood.
Some of them are long.
Yeah. Well, let's choose some of them.
Yeah. I think the one that I really, really enjoyed was we randomly came across this family, the Schwartzes, and they live in Cul-de-sac, Idaho. And it's a town of like 300, and we're supposed to end up at someone else's house, but we took a wrong turn, and the only directions we got is like, once you start going up this hill, there's going to be a giant mailbox sticking out of the street, and you turn right and that's the house. So we're going up this hill and there's a giant mailbox, so we turn right and we're like, are you the McDowells? And no, we're the Schwartzes, but the McDowells are like way over there. This point, it was already like 9 p.m. We had biked for like 60, 70 miles at this point. We're like exhausted and we're like, ugh, I don't want to go all the way to McDowell's. So they brought us into their home so warmly. She made me a giant T-bone steak, like just, you know, a stranger off the streets. And Ralph, Karen's husband, he is a wheat, barley, and canola farmer. And he was amazing. He's like, all right, girls, tomorrow morning, like, I'm going to take you on my combine. And a combine is like this giant machine that just eats up wheat or whatever you're harvesting. So the next morning, he took us up to his two babies, these machines, just so proud, and showed us how, you know, the process went. And it was amazing. And we're up in the hills of Idaho. You can see yellow fields of wheat everywhere, and they were just genuinely beautiful, nice people who were willing to take three dirty, crazy girls off the street. I think that was like a really special person.
What have you learned about the seed movement so far?
It seems like with every person that we talk to, a lot of these seed growers, and some of them just farmers, they all are very hopeful, and they have this hope that they want to share. I think it's more so their lifestyle and the way that they want to create the world as something that doesn't really, I guess, allow Monsanto or like big industry to leak in, but to think of varieties that they aren't using, sort of not fighting fire with fire, but finding other sources of water and ways.
Is it a cottage industry now?
I think, at least in my experience with talking to these different people, it seems like there are sort of these meccas or these hot spots, like any community forums where like-minded individuals come and sort of start these areas where people are starting to grow things and have this consciousness of, why are we losing all of this history associated with seeds, this biodiversity, you know, these things that really connect us where we are and to the places we live in. And so I think they're, from what we've seen, isolated but also connected.
I think it's definitely growing. One of the people we talked to, I think Don Tipping, he's trying to expand his seed company as well. And I think he exports all over the world to different countries, not even just within the United States at this point, because people are really starting to get into these like non-GMO, air-pollinated seeds. I think one thing that I really enjoyed learning about seeds is just that people are actually trying to combat like climate change with seeds. I think that was like one of the little tidbits of knowledge that I was just like, whoa, it's just like our food systems are going to be impacted by this climate change. And so all of these seed people are also thinking ahead and thinking like, okay, maybe we should start working with like native plants and trying to select them to better help us out in the future when our weather patterns start getting all jumbled. So that was like really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Briefly, I do want to talk about life on the road. May I ask, Carmen, how old are you?
I'm 23 years old.
Vicky?
I am also of the 23.
Coco?
I'm a quarter of a century old, sir.
Wow. Have you had any weird moments? Three young women on the open road. Your parents, your friends, they kind of be freaked out a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think they all think we're insane. Mm-hmm. But
my grandmother and my mother were talking, and they said, well, I guess Carmen's going. What do we do now? And my grandma said, well, all we can do is pray.
And I talked to my sister yesterday, and she's like, whoa, like, I haven't heard your name paired with the word crazy so many times within the last month.
Okay.
But I think at the same time, so many people have treated us with so much generosity. I don't think we've really run into any weird situations being young women, I feel really safe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so do I.
Why?
Yeah. I think one day people pulled over on the side of the road and just gave us Gatorades, trail mix bars, a bottle of wine. People are just consistently so giving and so open and so helpful.
But there's always that risk of the weirdo.
Yeah.
In the van.
But, you know, that's the same way as walking down your city street alone as a woman or as anyone. You know, there's always risk in everything we do. And I think that biking has really taught me that, you know, we're just exposed. We're exposed to the elements and to our environments, but also to the unknown. You just respond to that in the instance instead of closing yourself off and saying, okay, I'm going to go about my day-to-day this way and this way, and these are my fears and expectations and hopes. You know, I think that being on a bike and being in a group of women and meeting all of these people along the way has just opened up my idea about how we travel and that, like, feeling of safety and generosity.
Right. How many calories are you packing away a day?
Oh my God.
I can't even
All I know
count.
Is that we eat ice cream like maniacs.
Yeah, I'm sure you have to.
Yeah, it's one of the consistent things about our lifestyle is like, where are we going to get ice cream today?
Yeah. That's
kind of. How many miles a day?
Between 60 to 80.
We recently went to Adventure Cycling, which is also here in Missoula.
Of course.
They weighed our bikes for us. And we, like, all now know
what our burden is.
Yeah.
What is your burden?
My burden is my rock collection. I really like rocks that are in the shape of states. We choose to carry some silly things.
Yeah. My bike was 80 pounds.
80 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mine was,
Vicky? Mine was
88. Carmen.
92.
Wow, what are you hauling?
She has like 10 books.
No, she has a wardrobe.
Ever hear of a Kindle?
I know, it's funny because we also have the fortune of being gifted things, books from people.
When do you hope to pull into New York?
The beginning of October, before the seasons turn. Yeah.
What, Manhattan? Is that where you're headed? Or
we want to go to the other side of the coast, so I think we're going to have to bike to like Long Island or something.
Oh, I see. Best of luck. Carmen Taylor, Vicky Lee, Coco Barrios, real pleasure to meet you guys. Stay safe. Have a great time.
Thank you so much.
We
love Missoula, by the way.
Yes.
To find out more about Carmen, Coco, and Vicky's travels, visit seats2cities.com.
And in tonight's weather forecast for west of the Divide, tonight expect partly cloudy skies with a chance of rain showers and slight chance of thunderstorms. Lows will be in the 40s. Tomorrow will be mostly sunny with highs in the upper 70s to mid 80s. For central Montana, tonight calls for mostly cloudy skies with scattered showers and thunderstorms. Some thunderstorms may produce gusty winds, small hail, and heavy rainfall. Lows will be in the lower 50s. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a slight chance of thunderstorms through the day. Highs will be around 70 to 80 degrees. And for southwest Montana, tonight expect mostly cloudy skies with thunderstorms that may produce gusty winds, small hail, and heavy rainfall in the evening. Lows will be in the upper 50s. Tomorrow calls for sunny skies with highs in the upper 70s. And now for the editorial comments of Karen Knutson.
You know the old saying, if you don't like the weather in Montana, just wait 5 minutes. We're a state that's known for its wild weather changes. But in recent years, even our extremes have become extreme. Our fire seasons start sooner, last longer, burn hotter, and cost more to fight. Just 2 years ago, the historic floods of 2011 became one of the most expensive natural disasters in state history. And in the past month alone, we've seen intense wildfires and destructive flash floods, both of which have threatened lives and destroyed property. At the center of these extremes are Montana's vast river systems, which have taken a hard hit as severe drought, fire, and floods become the new norm. We can't change the weather, but there's a lot we can do for our rivers, creeks, and streams that will help make the impacts less severe. And right now, there's a proposal in Congress that will help. But first, let's talk about some of the practical, proven, and science-based measures that we know reduce the impacts of extreme weather. Take floodplain restoration. Restoring floodplains and riparian areas help rivers absorb the impact of floods and high runoff, thereby protecting homes and land as well as downstream communities. Then there's streamflow restoration. Returning water to thirsty streams helps ensure they have sufficient flow for fish and farmers, recreation and industry, even in late summer. More gains can be made by repairing damaged stream banks, which reduces erosion and prevents loss of cropland and property. And finally, there's managing weeds and restoring native vegetation. These actions help keep riverbanks healthy, lower stream temperatures, reduce fish mortality, and improve resiliency in the face of drought. For years, Montana ranchers and landowners have been using these measures like these to improve both their land and their bottom line. They know these improvements are the most cost-effective insurance policies money can buy. But unfortunately, there isn't enough money to do all that needs to be done. That's where the so-called Northern Rockies Headwaters Extreme Weather Mitigation proposal comes from. This bipartisan provision would provide up to $30 million to landowners and communities in Montana and Idaho for smart preventative measures that would restore, rehabilitate, and rewater our rivers and streams, helping to reduce the costly and life-threatening impacts of extreme weather. It also ensures that funds and projects are handled locally so that those who know their rivers best are in the driver's seat. Further, by targeting the headwaters of some of the largest river systems in the country, it benefits not only those of us here in the Northern Rockies, but hundreds of millions of people living downstream as well. It's money that's sorely needed here in Montana. Some 900 miles of tributaries in the Clark Fork watershed alone are considered chronically dewatered, many running completely dry each summer. The resources in this proposal would go a long way toward helping our thirsty streams. You might be surprised that in these tough economic times, Congress would propose spending any new funds, and even more surprised to find there is bipartisan support for doing so. But this is actually a cost-saving measure, as we already pay tens to hundreds of millions of dollars each year for preventable weather-related impacts. Drought-ravaged croplands cost our ranching communities dearly. Excessively warm rivers running green with algae harm fish and aquatic life and keep anglers and boaters away, hurting tourism. Flash floods put communities at risk, erode agricultural lands, and cost millions in property damage. The thing is, even if people don't agree on why we're seeing more extreme weather, they do agree that it's happening, and they agree that something must be done. The Water Resources Development Act, of which this provision is a part, is far from perfect. But the extreme weather mitigation proposal gets a lot of things very right. It's smart, it's cost-effective, it's science-based and guaranteed effective, and it's much needed as the impacts from drought, fire, and floods cost us more and more each year. That's something all of us can get behind. Sure, if you don't like Montana's weather, you could just wait 5 minutes for it to change. But when it comes to weather extremes that hurt our communities, our rivers, and our economy, we have to act. Restoring and repairing our rivers not only makes them more resilient, it makes us more resilient too. This bill has been passed in the Senate. The House version comes up for hearing next month. Please contact Representative Steve Daines today to encourage him to support this common sense bipartisan measure. With more extreme weather, no doubt, on the way, it's the smart thing to do. On behalf of Clean Water and the Clark Fork Coalition, I'm Karen Knutson.
Karen Knutson is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.